Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Steve LaSera, who's a longtime front-of-house engineer and tour manager for Blue Oyster Cult. But first, let's talk about something that happened this week. By the time you listen to this, which is probably a month later after I'm recording it, it may be a little different, but this is happening right now. It may not be resolved when you're listening to this, but that's YouTube is threatening to block the videos of indie label acts. And this is especially with acts that are signed to labels with the Worldwide Indie Network. The Worldwide Indie Network is sort of an association of small and large indie labels. What's happening is YouTube is trying to change their service because they realize that there's so much music that's being listened to. I think it's about a third of all their traffic. And they want to take advantage of that by making it more of a music service. And in fact, it is going to be, it may be a separate music service, it may be something that's connected to YouTube. We're not quite sure yet, but it's going to happen soon and may even have happened by the time you listen to this. That being said, this has caused Google, who owns YouTube, to go back and revisit all of their license agreements with major labels and with indie labels and with indie label associations. And the reason for this is YouTube wants to enable downloads of music. What they really want is for you to be able to download something so you don't have to be connected to the internet when you listen to it. In other words, you'll download some music, and or it'll be downloadable, it'll be tethered to your device. And later, what will happen is, if you're not connected, you'll still be able to listen to it. So that's the whole idea. But basically what's happening is the major labels are pushing for a new deal because of that, and they want to get paid more. And that's the whole source of the problem. Because YouTube wants to pay the major labels more than the indie labels, and the indie labels aren't standing for it. What the indie labels are saying is, we want to be paid exactly the same as the majors. And YouTube is basically saying, take it or leave it. So WIN, or the Worldwide Indie Network, is basically saying, okay, we're going to leave it. So as a result, YouTube has come back and said, okay, fine, but we're going to take down all of your videos off our network. Meaning that you won't be able to find any acts that are signed to either a major indie label or just any kind of indie label. So this sounds pretty ominous, and it is in a couple of ways. It's not quite as bad on one hand because this might not apply to fans that upload videos, like lyric videos and things like that, and that's actually substantial. If you look at any hit, you'll find that there's only one official music video, but there may be dozens of other unofficial videos. YouTube is even threatening to take those down, and the question is, do they really have the resources to be able to do that? Maybe yes, maybe no, and we don't quite know that, but it's a pretty good threat. All record labels have learned that they're making a lot of money off of YouTube, YouTube ads, and they don't want to give that up. What'll happen is that money will be cut off, and that's something that indie labels especially really need. So this is a pretty important decision, and we'll have to see how it plays out. I'm not exactly sure myself what'll happen. I think they'll probably meet in the middle, but maybe not, because the word is YouTube is being very, very stringent on what they want, and they're not moving too much. So we will see. Keep an eye on that. The next thing I want to talk about is finding the groove of a song. And actually, this was a question that I got this week. And it was, okay, explain to me what the groove is and how do I find it? So here's what it is. Every song has a groove. The groove is the pulse of the song. It doesn't matter what kind of music it is. If it's good, it has a pulse and you can feel it. So in other words, just pick a genre. It doesn't matter. If it's good, it will have a pulse and you can feel it. And if it isn't good, or if it isn't something that hits you in the right place, you won't feel it. And many times the reason is the groove is confused. You can't find which instrument is really providing it, or multiple instruments are providing slightly different grooves, so it's confusing. We can't quite feel it. This is what happens a lot with young bands. that don't quite know how to play together yet. The groove can come from the rhythm section, that's usually where it comes from, or it could come from like a rhythm guitar, or it could come from percussion. Bruce Swedeen, who engineered a lot of Michael Jackson's biggest hits, once told me that Michael's singing was so strong that he could provide the groove just from that. And if you listen to some of his demos, some of his just vocal-only demos, you can really hear that, as a matter of fact. So what happens is a bad band confuses the groove, and a good band knows how to listen to one another, so there's only one groove, and they can feel that pulse, and the whole band can feel the pulse, and the listener can feel that pulse as well. The best way for a band to figure that out is basically, you always use the phrase, how are you playing that? Because what I've found is, many times, players are playing something that's slightly different. So in other words, there may be something happening on the kick and snare. The bass player playing it differently, the accents in different places. Now, if that happens intentionally, that could be pretty cool, but sometimes it happens unintentionally because the two players aren't listening to one another. And it'd be very simple to figure that out by just saying, hey, how are you playing that? And then one guy going to the other one, or one player going to the other one. So if you're mixing, how do you find the groove? If it's not apparent, and it should be easily apparent, what is the groove? And the reason why we want to find the groove is, that's usually where we start a mix. If you ever see someone pulling up the kick drum first, or pulling the drums up first, really what they're trying to do is find the pulse of the song. If you find the pulse of the song, then the rest is kind of easy because they just fill in around it. And a lot of the classic engineers didn't mix from the drums way back when they only used one or two mics. They started from the bass, actually. And if you listen to a lot of the hits from the 50s and 60s, you don't hear the drums all that much, but the bass is what's giving it the pulse. So if you can't find the pulse, the easy way is just throw all the faders up so all the tracks are at a relatively even level. And then raise each track, a couple dB, 3 dB, maybe. At a certain point, you should be able to feel the pulse coming together. There should be something there that suddenly will give you the pulse. And you put a couple instruments around that, and all of a sudden, you'll feel a groove of the song. Now, of course, you can't easily build the pulse if it's not there in the first place. I mean, there are ways that you can actually go in and surgically put it together. But we're just talking about a very, very simple mix where it's all already in the grooves. It's already played. So the groove is the pulse of the song, and every song has one. Doesn't matter what kind of music or what the genre. If you're mixing, it's your responsibility to find that pulse, to make that pulse front and center, and to build your mix around it. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I love to hear your comments and suggestions that you have about the show. My guest today is Steve Lacerra, and he's the front-of-house mixer for Blue Oyster Cult. He's been doing it for quite a long time. He's also their tour manager as well. But Steve also has written a lot in EQ magazine. He still is a sound reinforcement editor for Mix. So undoubtedly, you've read many things that he's written. He's a great writer. He also teaches at Mercy College out on Long Island. I spoke with Steve via Skype from his studio on Long Island. So Steve, thanks for being with me today. It's been a long time since we talked, so this is great to catch up.
Yes, it is. My pleasure, Bobby.
Let's talk about the difference between engineering in the studio and engineering live, because you've been doing Blue Oyster Cult for a long time. Tell me, what are the differences for you?
Well, the biggest difference, I would say, is the time constraint. We often don't have the luxury of a sound check, although I would say over the past year or so, we've been making more and more of an effort to make that happen. But when we're on a festival bill, if there are multiple bands, that's often not possible. So we sort of go into what I call grab it and growl mode. And we basically just kind of have to fly by the seat of our pants Lucky for me, at this point, I have enough experience with them so that if I know that I'm getting the correct signal down the designated input channel, in other words, if I'm getting, let's say, Eric's vocal on Eric's vocal channel and not the hi-hat, then I'm actually in pretty good shape because I can get it dialed in probably 75 to 80% of the way in the first minute.
Whoa.
If not less. Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, so that's a
are you working on digital consoles so you can bring your presets along?
Yes. The tide over the last, I'd say, two and a half years has completely turned. I don't see analog desks much anymore. There was a fairly long transition period, but it's really turned the corner. In fact, I think the other night I had an analog desk for, it might be the first time all year.
Wow.
So that's helpful because if it's an Avid system or a Yamaha system, I have a file, which gets me the patching in terms of which channels get compression or gating. My effects are all there, my delays, my reverbs. That's all there. My gain structure is not because we don't carry a mic package. So although I may have gain dialed up in a preset, it's not necessarily valid because the microphones are different.
Yeah.
And the backline is almost always different because we're on rental backline 90% of the time.
Wow. That must make it kind of interesting then.
Interesting is a good word.
What changes the most? Is it the guitars or the drums?
I'm going to say at this point, I think it's more the drums. Buck is using a Two Notes Torpedo, which is a amplifier simulator.
Oh, yeah.
So I have lately not even used microphones on his rig.
So
it's very consistent. Rich Castellano has been carrying his preamp and power amp with him. We're able to fit that in a very small road case that flies, so that helps as well. The drums, we've run into, you know, a kit here or there that maybe doesn't sound as nice as I would hope. Although interestingly, our drummer Jules is a Thai endorsed artist. And the Thai kits have been stellar.
No kidding.
They really have. And we have yet to have a Thai kit that didn't sound great.
Wow.
Yeah, and we've heard. Yeah. So that's kind of cool. But sometimes we'll run into a kit that is not what he had requested. And you know, occasionally maybe the bearing edges aren't right or something like that. Or there's not time for us to change the heads and tune them.
Do you bring anything with you?
Personally, yeah. I bring headphones and I bring my USB sticks, and that's about it.
Wow. Gone were the days where you had to bring a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, there was a time when I traveled with a rack for them where I had a couple of compressors and a few Lexicon PCMs, but that was one of the first things to get cut post 9/11 when the airlines started getting picky about charging for baggage.
Yeah, right.
So I don't even carry tools. I used to carry a small toolkit, but basically it's headphones, you know, a mag light, maybe some tape and Sharpies, and then I've always got to have my computer and my printer that I'm dragging around for the tour managing stuff. So I've already got my hands full.
Yeah, I bet. When you're mixing, are you trying to make them sound like the record, or does it matter?
I try to respect the record. I definitely do, to the best of my ability. But it's not always easy because their songs have evolved over the years, so they're not playing some of them quite like they played them on the recordings. But I sort of feel like we owe it to the fans to try to get in that ballpark as much as possible.
Since they have a lot of experience, they've been doing it for so long, and you've been doing it with them a lot, long time, does that make it easier or harder? Are they picky? Are they looking for something in particular, or are they just like, well, okay, been there, done that, anything works?
I think there's a little bit of both. That Buck is on the eternal quest for the ultimate guitar tone.
Yeah.
So he'll experiment and he'll change his rig, maybe add a pedal or take a pedal away. He's always up for trying new things. And some of the other guys, maybe not so much. Eric is very consistent. He plays his Gibson SG. He plugs it into a Mesa Boogie and off he goes. And that's been very consistent.
That's helpful.
Yeah, and it's a great tone too.
What are the hardest rooms for you to work in? Hardest kinds of rooms?
Large reflective rooms tend to be the most difficult. In particular, one that comes to mind recently was we played a place in, I think it's Huntington, New York, called the Paramount. I think it used to be the IMAC Theater. It's got a very high ceiling, and at the time, I think this was their first show, so they had just installed the PA, and there was no sound treatment in the room. And it was a little tough because the reverb times were hanging very live, hard floor, hard surface walls. That tends to be the toughest kind of room. Outdoors is usually the easiest because I don't have to deal with room reflections.
Yeah. What kind of PAs are you running into? Are they consistent?
I would say generally yes. A good proportion of the systems I get are line arrays, either JBL Vertec or the EVs. We see a fair amount of VDOS rigs. Occasionally I'll get an old bunch of beat up boxes like I had last weekend, which was serviceable, you know, not as nice sounding as I would have hoped, but it worked. They bark.
Right. Well, you and I both remember the old days where we had horn-loaded cabinets everywhere.
Yep.
I always thought they sounded a whole lot better than the line arrays, the modern systems that we have now. I don't. Maybe it's the generation of mixers, or I'm not sure what it is exactly. What do you think?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think I've seen, and I hate to sound like a stuffy old fart, but I've seen on more than one occasion rather young engineers, and when I say young, I'm talking, let's say, early 20s, mixing a classic rock band as if they were Five Finger Death Punch. I probably shouldn't name the band. There was one band in particular that we played with last summer that I was a big fan of all for many, many, many years. And the engineer just ruined them because he had this big fat kick drum, and you know, the big snare, and there's a horn section up there, and you know, the guitar players are playing intricate parts, and there's horn lines and harmony vocals. And I'm just watching it going like, what are you doing? You know, this is not what this band was intended to sound like. So that may be part of it. And I think maybe some engineers perceive that that's what an audience is expecting.
Yeah, see, I have a theory that there's a whole generation of mixers that learn the wrong way. They learn that you start from the kick drum, you make it as big as possible, and you lay everything over it. Where, I don't know about you, but the way I learned, especially for live, you take the quietest thing on the stage and you work with that first, which is usually the vocal, and you build around that because otherwise you won't hear it. You'll lose
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, especially in a room that's prone to feedback, because you're only going to be able to get the lead vocal, you know, to whatever that level is, and then the room just won't take anymore. And if you're starting with the big fat kick drum and the big raunchy guitars, well, where are you going to put the vocals?
Yeah.
And when we sound check, often, not always, but often, if I don't know the room, after I've got my gains set, and I'm sort of kind of playing around with the instruments and the vocals, I'll pull everything out and just leave the vocals up for a few minutes and then sort of ease the band back in behind that and massage it slowly instead of, you know, trying to put everything in your face all at once.
Oh, smart guy. Yeah, definitely. Do you run into systems where the subs are like roaring and you think way too loud?
Frequently. Frequently, I'll ask the systems engineer to dial the level of the subs back, or I will run the send to the subs off of an aux send so that I can dial a little more control in over it, and then I can simply back down that aux send on the kick drum and the bass guitar. That's my preference.
Yeah, it seems like that's a trend where, and that probably doesn't help the sound at all, of the low end, where all of a sudden you have six subs where you could have gotten away with two, and they're just roaring.
Yep, or I'd rather have the six and run them at 25 or 30%.
Yeah.
Than not have to beat them up all night.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
That's part of my philosophy as well. I'd rather be mixing on a system that's got tons of headroom and not hit the gas pedal than be running a system near its limit.
Is there a piece of gear that you rely on when you're mixing?
My ears.
Good for you. Good answer.
I can't say that there is. I don't have that luxury.
Yeah.
I think if we had the ability to carry a mixing console for front of house, I would love to do that. I'd love to carry even something as modest as like a Yamaha M7. You know, that would be wonderful. But I don't have that luxury.
And why is that better than a rental M7, for instance?
The only difference would be if I had it, that I would have it every night if we carried it.
Yeah.
But it's not. You know, a rental is perfectly acceptable. And I find in particular that the architecture of most of the Yamaha consoles is all pretty consistent. So if you know how to use one of them, you're pretty well at home on all of them. I mixed on a CL1 maybe a few weeks ago, which is their relatively new mixer, and it's a no-brainer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Have you seen the new little Midas consoles?
I mixed on a Pro, I think it was a Pro 2, a little baby.
Yeah.
Little baby desk with, I think it had 8 faders and 8 masters. It sounded fantastic. The footprint is barely bigger than my lap.
Yeah.
It took me a little bit of paging, and it took me a couple of hours between sound check and the show to get comfortable. But I would say by a few songs into the show, I was rocking it. It was good.
I think we're talking about the same one. I saw this at NAMM, at Summer NAMM, Winter NAMM, and I couldn't get over it. It was amazing. There was such big bang for the buck. It was only like $5,000 or $6,000. And I looked at this, I thought, this is impossible to put all this stuff in there. But that's
all there. Yeah, it's amazing. It really is.
It's actually interesting that Behringer would buy them. And yes. They told me that everything was built now in Behringer City in China.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, right. But they also swore that anything that was analog was Midas. And so you would know if it sounded like that or not.
That's good to hear. I think the one you may be referring to is the X32.
That's the one, right. Yes.
I have limited experience with that. It does sound very good.
Do you ever have to mix monitors for the band?
Not if I can help it. I don't have the patience.
Yeah.
As a rule, we do not mix monitors from front of house. Although there was a show, and I'm not going to remember the city. There's a county fair somewhere in California where, as a rule, monitors are done from front of house.
Whoa.
And as much as we barked and squawked about it, we couldn't change it. However, having said that, they had a 56-input console at house. So we were able to split key channels. And at the time, we had a monitor guy with us. His name is Andrew Gearhart. He kind of floats in and out depending upon how busy he is with other acts. And we were side by side. So he was on the right-hand side of the console. We had split the channels so that he could do what he needed to. And then I was mixing the band for the house.
Smart.
So I may have dialed in a little bit, you know, of some of the simpler things like hi-hat or overheads, and he was handling the lion's share of the work. But it was pretty cool because we were side by side.
Yeah.
Wow. It was interesting. Other than that, no, I avoid that. I don't have the patience.
Yeah, yeah. I don't blame you. That's the hardest job in show business, I think.
Absolutely.
How did you get the gig?
good story. In 1993, I lost a job. I had a full-time job, and the place closed down on short notice. And I had a friend of mine who had been doing a lot of guitar tech work for various bands. So I mentioned to him that I was looking for work. He was friends with the guitar tech for Blue Oyster Cult at the time. They called me and asked me to do drum tech for a weekend. My ultimate goal was certainly, you know, to mix front of house. But I said, you know, I needed the work. I needed some dough. And I felt like I could certainly be a good drum tech because I know my way around a kit. So I did a weekend with them and sort of felt that, you know, that was going to be it. But inside of a week or two, they called me again to sub for 2 and 3 weeks at a time. So over that summer, I subbed for them on and off. And then in the following year, I subbed a little bit as well, but not as much. And then in 95, they started calling me to sub for their sound engineer. And then in 97, he left, and it became my gig. So I've been doing front of house for them steadily since 97, and I also took on tour managing in, I think it was 04.
Wow.
So I'm well past the lifespan of a Blue Oyster Cult tour manager.
I would say, yeah. Congratulations for getting there.
Thank you. I think they're going to get me a gold watch.
Okay, so what is it that you love the most about mixing live?
There is definitely a rush involved under certain circumstances. When we're in a pressure situation where, you know, let's say we're flying from point A to point B and we get delayed and it's a disaster and, you know, the promoter's got cars waiting for us at the airport to take us straight from the airport to the stage. I put the guys on stage. I throw the faders up. That's fun to me. Mm-hmm. When I can do that and throw up a mix that's reasonably good, that's a tremendous rush. That's exciting to me.
Well, it's kind of the same in the studio where you have a group of musicians and you're tracking and everything's under pressure. I was talking to somebody the other day. I think it was on another podcast, actually. We were talking about doing commercials. And I was saying, when I used to track commercials, you'd have 3 hours. The first hour was the band. The second hour was all the overdubs. And the third hour was a mix, and everybody was out the door.
Wow. That's an intense schedule.
Yeah. And the thing about it is, it was kind of cool because no matter what, everything had to work. There's no going back ever. And, you know, you were under pressure for those 3 hours, but it's also a lot of fun.
Yep. It hones your craft too. I think it makes your appreciation for understanding signal flow it takes it to a new level. Yeah. Because I feel like when you're dealing with that sort of a situation, you really need to be able to solve problems quickly. And a lot of times they're signal flow related, whether it be a busted mic cable, or, you know, a DI that doesn't work because the phantom power is not reaching it, or something like, you need to have that logic to follow the map as quickly as possible, get a message to somebody to say, change that DI, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, troubleshoot the problem and get it solved as quickly as possible.
Well, what kind of problems do you usually run into? Is it stuff like that, or is it microphones that are swapped, channel swaps, things like that?
Occasionally it'll be a channel swap. Sometimes Rich's guitar channel and Eric's guitar channel will be swapped because their cabinets are next to each other. I had an interesting issue the other day where it appeared as if the faders on the mixing desk. It was an analog desk. It was an old analog desk. It was an old PM 4000.
Oh boy.
And at this point, I'm guessing those things were about 30 years old.
Yeah.
And if they haven't been well maintained, they're not happy. And this one looked like it had not been well maintained. Really beat up. It had nicotine stains on the knobs. Oh, and I'm looking at it going, oh boy, this is going to be bad. But the systems tech assured me that he had maintained it. So we start our sound check, and I'm dialing in my trim controls, and then I start pushing faders up, and it appears that some of the faders are intermittent, and that I'm only getting audio on them when I'm pushing them, let's say, within the last, you know, say from -5 to +10, like just that last little bit of throw. But otherwise, I'm not hearing the channel.
Yeah.
So first I noticed this on the vocals, and I tell the systems engineer, you know, what's the story here? I can't mix like this. We can't have this kind of a situation on my lead vocals. So I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe I'll repatch them to empty channels down on the other side of the console. But then I see that it's happening on a lot of channels. Well, it turns out, unbeknownst to me, there's a two-channel compressor on the house feed. So it's mixing console into an EQ, EQ into the two-channel compressor. That compressor also has a gate built in. The gate was partially closed. So what we were hearing was the gate chattering.
And you're dropping below threshold. So yeah, right.
Exactly. So after I realized what was going on, I walked over to the gate and I'm like, oh, okay. So we turn the threshold down all the way to get the gate out of the path and everything's fine.
Wow, that's an unusual
one. That's a different style in the memory banks.
Whoa, who would expect that?
I certainly didn't.
Yeah, well, who would? Nobody would. Jeez. What's the thing that you hate most about mixing? Dislike. Hate's too strong a word.
About mixing?
Yeah. Is there something that really bugs you?
No. Well, okay. There are two things that bug me.
See, I knew there was something.
Now I'm thinking a little bit. Okay, here's one thing that bugs me. PAs that are not properly deployed. And by that, what I mean is a system that has not been hung properly, or if it's traditional boxes, not line array boxes, where the person who has either installed or set up the system feels that their unorthodox approach is better than that which has been intended by the manufacturer. So, for example, if you have trapezoidal boxes, there's a good chance that the manufacturer intended that those boxes be pushed up next to each other so that the horns don't interfere and you don't get comb filtering. And yet I'll see people who ignore those traditions, I guess, or manufacturers' guidelines.
Yeah.
That really bugs me. Because it causes a lot of problems that can be very easily solved just by following the manufacturer's instructions. And, you know, God knows all these companies have so many resources, you know, in terms of helping you fly and aim cabinets and angle them and how many do you need for, you know, this amount of audience in the room, and, you know, they'll help you with the height and the angle and all that. So there's really no excuse for it anymore. I run into that once in a while. I ran into it recently once or twice this year. So it sort of stuck out. So that kind of bothers me. The manufacturers have invented their wheel. They know what to do with it. I certainly don't challenge that.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I find upsetting when mixing is just if the room is too lively and you can't overcome the ambient reflections and the reverberation time of the room. Yeah. You know, if it was up to me, I'd have a truckload of acoustic treatment and bring it in.
Oh, if only, huh?
Yeah.
When you come back to the studio, do you have to adjust your ears?
I don't think so. I think I make a pretty good transition.
You obviously must have a different approach, though, right, in the studio? Or maybe you don't. I don't know.
I do. I think I take a lot more... I take a lot more time in the studio.
Yeah,
absolutely. I experiment tons. I'll try you know, different overheads for a drum kit or, you know, different kick drum mics. I'll try stuff that maybe wasn't intended to be used for a certain application. Whereas live, I don't experiment like that.
Yeah.
I don't usually have the time.
Yeah, right. Would you if you had the time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But especially guitars and drums.
Whoever has that time, though, right?
Very rare. Once in a blue moon, if I get a microphone to review or if a manufacturer loans me something to check it out, if we have time and it's a leisurely day where we have a sound check, you know, we'll put it up on a guitar amp or something like that. But that's not very often, unfortunately.
What's the thing that you learned that helped you most in your job?
Have a good attitude. I think that that transcends, even to some extent, your technical abilities. Not to downplay the technical abilities, but I think I would rather, speaking as a tour manager, I would rather have a tech on my crew that has a good attitude and asks for and needs my help than a great tech that causes me problems. Yeah. Because when people say, and you hear this all the time, a house crew says they worked with a band, whatever that band is, you know, insert the name of your favorite band. Oh, those guys were great to work with. They say the band was great to work with. They're not referring to the band. The band is only there for an hour and a half. They're really referring to the crew.
Right.
And my approach is that it's my job to make sure that the dates we do stay on the calendar year after year, you know, that we go back to Mohegan Sun or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I think part of that is just, you know, getting along with people, having a good day. It's not rocket science. You know, there are far more serious things in the world to be worried about. So
yeah.
Try to get a little on the light side.
Yeah, but you know, that's a good point, because people only want to work with people that they like to be around, you know?
Yeah.
And especially if you're on the road, geez, there's nothing worse than being on the road with somebody that you don't like or you can't get along with.
That is very true.
You can kind of do it in the studio and get through a project, but yep. Boy, on the road, it's a different story.
And it's magnified because we tend to be clustered together. Like if we're flying, obviously we're getting to the airport together. You know, we're hanging out at the gate together. We're all, I have to say, everybody watches each other's back. They all pitch in if need be. So it's good kind of family thing, which helps a lot.
What's the best piece of business advice that you either received or you learned?
Probably to be on time or be early.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find a disheartening number of my students haven't got that yet.
Yeah, I know.
And some of them have asked to work with me in Blue Oyster Cult. And for most of them, the answer is you have no chance. You can't even be to class on time.
Yeah.
You know, I can't wait for you at an airport.
Yeah.
Or to leave from a hotel. I'll leave you there.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, someone once explained to me that to be on time was to be late. You know,
to be late?
Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, you always have to be there ahead of time.
Yeah. Yeah. What's that expression? If you're not 15 minutes early, you're 10 minutes too late.
Yeah, something like that. But it's all true, really. I have right. to say that I always get major agita if I'm not, you know, getting... If I know I'm going to be late, even if it's a minute or two, it really bugs me. And it could be something that's, you know, very innocuous. Meeting a friend for lunch or something, it still bugs me, you know. And a lot of that has to do with being on the road and just having, you know, that regimental time. You know, you have to do things in time or else, you know, there's going to be something suffering down the line.
That's right. And I think it adds stress.
Oh, big time.
Something I don't need.
yeah. Well, on the road, especially in the studio, again, you can get around a lot of that. But boy, I used to work with a bass player that his expression was, what do you mean? I'm not even a half hour late yet. I was constantly late, and it made everybody crazy. And you know, to him, that was just the way he did business. But he didn't do it all that long when it was all said and done, because the first time there was a chance to replace him, he was gone.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. It doesn't matter about your ability at a certain point.
If you can't show up, your abilities kind of become a moot point.
So tell me about teaching. So you transitioned into teaching.
Yeah, I've been teaching at Mercy College since 2003. They're now, our department is now located in the Dobbs Ferry campus. It was at the White Plains campus until a few years ago, but they closed that and moved us over to Dobbs Ferry, which is a beautiful location. And the rumor is that they're building us a new studio in the fall.
Oh, boy.
Which is nice. So I'm hoping that that's going to happen. That's sort of been postponed once or twice already. So I'm hoping that this time they mean it.
Yeah.
And we have a four-year music technology program. I tend to teach the recording workshop classes, the sound reinforcement classes, and a class called Audio Systems Design and Installation, where the students learn a little bit about recording studio design, acoustics, basic room geometry, patch bay layout and design, soldering, that sort of thing.
That's a good course.
It is. The program is really good. It's,
I go and I teach in a lot of colleges. That where I go and I lecture, I give a clinic, and you know, all over actually. And I have rarely heard about that last program that you had.
Really?
Something like that. No, I rarely do I see something like that. The only place I can think of was like Belmont College in Nashville had something similar that I can remember. But other than that, that's never, it's never in a curriculum that I can see. But I think it's something that's really needed.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think my students get a kick out of it, because there's always one of them that gets a call from a friend who can't wire a patch bay.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can. And I said, well, I hope you're going to charge your friend for this.
Yeah, right. Well, this has been great. Thanks a lot for your time, Steve. It was good to catch up again and hear about what you're doing. And as always, you're on the road exploits.
Thank you, Bobby. It's my pleasure.
If you want to find out more about Steve, go to blueoystercult.com, or you can read his articles in Mix Magazine or Mix Online. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the guy behind the scenes here that makes this podcast run. He's also the host of EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. To listen to my other episodes of Bobby O's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosensky.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to Bobby O Inner Circle, or you can find it on iTunes. At bobbyosensky.com, you can read excerpts from my books, there are links to my blogs, coaching programs, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, and for alerts for this podcast as well. This is Bobby Osinski. See you next time.